Well, welcome to the Nitty Gritty Law Library. The Nitty Gritty Law Library does not exist, but it's a nice name, and so I use it. We're not an organization. It's just me, and but the motto that I have when I engage in these activities is, through the courts, encouraging the government to obey the law. I've sometimes been accused of being anti-government, rebellious, crazy, and so forth. But in truth, my background is that I'm a business systems designer. I made rules for other people to follow. I love the governmental system. I support it. What I don't support is the abuse. And that's really what it's all about. When we get entrepreneurial government people who want to make their own law in violation of Magna Carta, which says that no official can subject anyone to his own law without faithful witnesses and evidence. That means somebody who doesn't work for the government, and it means two or more witnesses. Then, you know, when they start abusing their power, that's when I tend to object. And so I have found through actual experience that the courts are quite reasonable, but only if you do your part in making them reasonable. The judges, 95% of them fall right in line once I let them know what we're working with, what we're doing. There's 5% that need a second chance. And to show you how well it works, in the last 30 years that I've been playing this game, only once have I had to take it to the third level. I only found one judge that was an absolute tyrant. I mean absolute. He would not yield. I fined him for contempt of court at least a half dozen times. And to him, it was just paperwork, and he really didn't care. And so I finally had to go to the ultimate step, which is I issued a bench warrant for his arrest. And I gave him a courtesy copy at the same time as I served the sheriff with a copy. And when he saw that, it was almost an instant turnaround. Okay? He wasn't going to risk getting arrested. And so, but this, other than that one instance, we have mostly fast learners on the bench. We have 5% that are slow learners. I find it really works. But you have to get it right. You have to have your theory down, and then you have to have your form correct. Bureaucrats seem to favor form over substance, but common law is substance over form. So what we're here for today is to cover form. We won't cover much theory. We have on the website 1215.org. We have plenty of theory and a little light on form. So I'm finally getting around on form. Years ago, I didn't understand procedure. I had the theory down, but then it was like, what do you do? How do you do it? You know. So that's what we're here for today. And hopefully, I've done my homework enough. Hopefully, you guys have done your homework. I know not everybody has, but the homework assignment was to read the foundation page and follow the instructions on the foundation page. That way you would have enough exposure that it would make it easier to understand the paperwork. However, if you haven't done your homework, that's okay too, because I probably won't have to explain too much in order to get it understood. Okay, so the first thing is, you need to understand what the paperwork is all about. Basically, in every system, you have your formalities. So in our social system, we write friendly letters to each other. In the business world, we have a specific format for writing letters. Well, the court systems are no different. We have a format for writing letters. Anytime you file an action or a complaint or make a motion, what you're doing is you're writing a letter, okay? And you're trying to get some point made when you write that letter. And the letter has a specific format. So here's the big picture. Whenever you want something from the court, you write a letter to it. And namely, what the format is you put a caption at the top, you have particular spacings, all according to the rules in the court. And you'll find it does specify, for example, you have a 1-inch margin, you use 12-point type, and so forth. It's all in the rules. And the letters to the court have special names depending on what you're asking for. It's either an action or a complaint or an answer or reply, whatever it is, but they have these different names. The court also writes letters to the they write their letters back, and they're a little looser, they're a little more flexible in format, and they're usually called notices, minute orders, rulings, orders, and judgments, and so forth, but they're not so tightly controlled. I believe the rule makers prefer that we follow the rules but give themselves a little more freedom. When you write a letter to a court, you always have a purpose. You don't just write a letter. You're writing a letter because you want something. Okay? And the first letter to the court is typically called a complaint or an action or a petition or also a declaration. Later letters are usually called motions, appeals, requests, right? Petitions, whatever. So in an action at law, which is what we're focused on here, you have all elements present. In equity court, you can leave out some things and fill in the blanks later if you wish. But with common law, you have to be 100%. So typically in a complaint in equity, the actual facts are withheld and presented later in discovery, depositions, or at trial. But ultimately, when you get to the end of the process, you have to do everything in equity that you did in you would do in common law. Now, if you look at an action at law, let's see if I can enlarge this. Let's see. Here we go. There. Is that better? Everybody can see that now?
Yes.
So, in an action at law, these are kind of the elements of an action at law. You have to identify who the parties are. You have to identify the forum. What forum are you in? You put in a little summary of the case. You put in the facts. You put in the law. You put in the claim for the damages. In other words, you have injuries and you want the injuries paid for with damages. And this claim for damages is known. I'm going to have to correct that. It actually should be a claim for injuries. Okay. But and then you argue your points. You have to have a proof of service. The proof of service basically is to prove that the court doesn't know, it's not there to watch you, so you have to tell it that, yeah, you delivered the paperwork. You did deliver the copies of the letter to everybody. Everybody who's involved is entitled to a copy of everything that goes on. You can provide a proposed judgment, and then there's a summons issued by the clerk. That's an order from the court telling a person to respond. And a proof of service, which usually accompanies a summons. So these are all elements in an action at law. And you notice that in a motion, if you make a motion in the court, it's very similar. Really, you have all the same things there. You have a notice of motion, okay? And that kind of is the same thing as the summons. The summons is a notice that you're being sued, as well as an order to show up. You have the actual motion that correlates with the demand that you make in your action at law, sometimes called a prayer. Okay. You have the law of the case. Well, you've got the law of the case in the action. Your brief covers points being made, authority supporting it, and argument. And there it is. You got the points, authorities, and argument. So, really, there's not much difference between your action and your motions. They're all letters to the court, and you got to get this information in order for to justify the court in making whatever decision it's going to make. Here's how the case typically flows. You have a notice and demand. This is outside the court. But interestingly enough, if you're in your sovereign capacity, your court is open at all times. So this is actually the first step in your court process. Even though you may not be in a court building, it is your court. Okay? And so you send out a notice and demand to somebody. Somebody's stepping on your toe and they don't know you're stepping on your toe, or maybe they do know. But you have to let them know. You give them a notice. You say, hey, you're stepping on my toe. And then you ask them to get off your toe. And if he apologizes and gets off, well, then usually that's the end of it, because in our system of thought, we don't usually punish somebody for an honest-to-goodness accident. But if the person says, so what? Well, then that's the call to arms, you know. Now you go after him, because now you know he's stepping on your toe on purpose. But you don't know until you give him the notice and see the response. So that's why you have to have a notice. And that's why the courts demand that you make a demand on the person before you bring it into the court, the actual court building. Okay, but once you make a decision that this is not an accident, well, then you have to sue them. And so that's called an action. Now, a complaint is the word you use for an equity proceeding. But an action is the word you use for common law proceeding or common law suit. Sometimes we use the word lawsuit, and I'm guilty of using that word all the time myself. But what a lawsuit is actually is this. Years ago, the equity court and the common law court were actually two separate buildings, two separate areas, two separate judges. The judge in the common law court was called a judge, but the judge in the equity court is actually called a chancellor. So you have chancellors there and judges in the other one. Well, and so you had law in your common law courts, you had equity in your equity courts, and the equity courts served to bring in instant law where there was no law to cover the situation. So that's how the English courts operated. Well, in America, we're innovative, and we always have new and improved. Usually the price is higher and the quality is lower, but nevertheless, it's new and improved. And so in our new and improved system here in the United States, we merged together the common law courts and the equity courts. And now you have still two courts because they're still separate in the Constitution, but you have the same personage acting as both judge and chancellor. So that kind of helps to throw in some confusion. And you will actually find in your code books, like in Title 18, I think it's Title... No, not Title 18. Title 28, you'll find in, I think it's Rule 7, there's two rules there that essentially are opposite, and that's because one of them is equity and the other is common law, but they don't identify them as such because they're really trying to get it into one system and get away from this idea of it. But there are reasons why there are the two systems. And so, in my own personal opinion, I like having them the old way better because it was well thought out. But when they put them together, you see the word law, without qualification, the word law means common law. If you qualify it, Like, for example, you say statutory law, then it's not law, it's actually statutes. Well,
when they call it state law, what does it mean? Repeat that.
When they call it state law, he asked, we'll get to you. When they call it state law, then that is obviously statutes and codes, because there is no common law for the states, okay? But the common law is the law of the people. But to finish this thought, you have law on one hand, an action at law, and then you have, in equity, a suit. Well, when they merged the two systems together, you had a lawsuit. And that's why we use that term today. Go ahead.
I've heard you say that there's always a remedy in common law. Why
yes.
would you need to have two separate courts then if you've already got a form for a remedy in common law?
Right. Well, it's actually a carryover from the English system where the judges themselves in the English system were not allowed to make up new law. And so they had to go... See, the chancellor was the king's right-hand man, and he acted just like the king when the king wasn't around, and he could make up law on the spot.
And that would move it to common law after that point? I
mean, No. Common...
We're not getting... Stay at the mic. Sorry. I'll say it again. Mm-hmm.
So then... Forgot how I phrased it, but then so he yeah. created the common law after he ruled
no,
on it?
No, that was equity law, and equity law you expected consistency, so it developed case law, which is part of equity, and you have that whole system there. It practically becomes a law system. Now, part of the confusion here is this. That was called equity, and then the statutes and codes that were passed by the parliament, That was called the common law, the law of the king. Okay, so somebody's cell phone is ringing. So I'm going to ignore it. So that was called the common law, but then there's actually a dual meaning here, because the real common law is the law of the people. Or the Magna Carta, if the people choose. The Magna Carta is only common law if the defendant says, I want it to be. The king cannot force the Magna Carta on a person. And so that was called common law for the people. And then what the king did, that was equity. But then the equity split into two branches, one of which was called common law and the other was called equity. So that double meaning is a confusion, see? Anyway, go ahead.
My question is, all these actions that we're talking about today apply to Superior Court and the courts in California, not circuit courts, which are federal courts, right?
No, it applies to everywhere. Yes, it applies it to all courts. In other words, Well, actually, let's put it this way. When you go into court and you're the sovereign of the court, it's your court no matter where you are. So you may be in those buildings, but it's your court. And remember this, that if you're one of the people of the jurisdiction, like one of the people of the United States or one of the people of California or one of the people of New York, if you're one of the people, you own the outfit. So if you name your court with the exact same name that the government is using, that's just fine. They're both yours. Yes?
You mentioned that the states have no common law.
Right.
Can you explain that? Because the state has a constitutional...
Well, yes. Well, it really... that whole concept has its roots in the... I think it's the Tenth Amendment. The Tenth Amendment basically says that the enumeration of the rights... do I have that right now? No, I got it wrong. I think it's a Ninth Amendment, I think, that reserves all rights to the people. The only authority that any of these governmental units have is the authority that the people granted to them through the Constitution. If the authority was not granted, then they can't do it. whatever it is.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Oh, he had said when us three didn't.
Oh, that's right. Right.
My understanding was that all of the states did adopt common law except for Louisiana. Then they adopted the Napoleonic Code. Is that not correct? Or?
That's not correct.
Okay.
See, if they adopted it, they adopted it by using statutes and making up statutes.
Ah.
Yeah. See, they can't do anything unless it's authorized. They are not allowed to be entrepreneurial. Well, the legislature is allowed to be entrepreneurial within the limits of authority granted by the Constitution. So, whereas the people are different. If in the common law, if you have a grand jury, for example, the grand jury can make up any law it wants and make what's called a presentment. And with that presentment, you can now have a petite jury decide whether or not it was violated. So, because they're all sovereigns, the grand jury is sovereign. Oh, by the way, that's a grand jury of 25. The grand juries we have today are all of them throughout the United States are fewer than 25. They're statutory grand juries, which is not the same thing. Yes?
Can you request or demand to get 25 jurors?
Well, I would say no, because they're not authorized. Okay? If you read the Magna Carta, Article 61... you'll find that the grand jury elects itself. It rises up from the people or from the nobility in England. You know, and we're all part of the nobility. You want a jury of your peers, right? What does the word peer mean? It means somebody who's a member of the peerage. And what is the peerage? Well, that's the nobility. And here in America, everybody's a member of the nobility because everybody's sovereign. Okay, so because of the fact that we're all equal on that level, we've all, through our wonderful educational system, we've set the sovereignty concept aside, and we now think the word peer means equal, but it actually means being a member of the peerage. In fact, there was a case in San Diego. At the time I heard about this, I didn't have the appreciation that I do now of these things. Otherwise, I would have been more careful to acquire more information. But what happened was this guy was charged with something, and he demanded a jury of his peers. And nobody in the jury pool would admit that they were not citizens of the United States. You know, they wouldn't admit they were people. Okay? So the judge finally ordered the sheriff to go up and gather up some people wherever he could find them. And the sheriff reported back he couldn't find any. So they had to let the guy go. He couldn't get a jury of his peers. Well, anyway, so you have this confusion of terms. You've got the common law of the people and the equity law of the king. And then the equity law of the king is divided in two parts. One branch is called common law, and that's where you have fixed rules, and then you have equity law, which is what the chancellor or the king himself would do. So you kind of have to know which one you're talking about. I believe it's intentional confusion. You know, ultimately, if everybody's convinced we should have common law, say, oh yeah, come on over. We got common law. The king has it. You know, so that's how they get you in jurisdiction. They get you to agree to things that you didn't know you were agreeing to. Anyhow, the case flows. You get an action, and once you've put together your action, then your normal next step is the other person answers. Okay, and then after he answers, your next step is you go to trial. Okay, that's typically the pattern. But you can throw in a few other things. For example, after you do an action, you kind of look around and see if the defendant owns any property. And if he does, you can put a preservation of interest on it. Now, in California, you probably all have heard of a lis pendens. Mm-hmm. Okay? Well, in California, The Attorney General apparently has informed the county recorders that they do not have to accept the list pendants from anybody except an attorney. Okay? So when you go to file a list pendants, a lot of counties, they simply won't accept it. They don't tell you the alternative, which is called a preservation of interest. If you do a preservation of interest, in my mind, the preservation of interest in the codes is actually the common law being codified, okay? Because you can't block out the people from their rights. And so you put a preservation of interest, and that has all the same effect as a list pendants. And we've really screwed up some loans for some people, you know, who thought they could just get away with anything, and then it turned out that, oh, we put effectively a list pendants on their property, and then they couldn't get, loans would be canceled and that sort of thing. Okay, but then after you do the preservation of interest, it's entirely possible, well, you'll get into motions. And there's different kinds of motions, but one of the big ones is a demur. And a demur is wonderful. I love demurs. I'll get to that in just a moment. But there are all kinds of motions, and you might have a problem with the judge at that point, especially when you start ruling on your own motions. And so you might end up in contempt proceedings against the judge. So we'll get into that too a little later, how you get a judge in contempt. But back to motions, after that you have answers. And so the defendant would answer. Well, when he answers, what he's doing is he's addressing the facts and the law. Okay, in your action you put the facts and the law, among other things. But in the answer, he'll come back and he'll maybe argue against the facts. He'll say, no, your facts are wrong, this is what really happened. Or he might argue the law, typically argues both. But if he's in agreement with the facts, then, and all he's doing is arguing the law, then he does a demur. Demur effectively is half an answer. Okay? Well, the beautiful part about a demur, attorneys love to do demurs, I've noticed. They do that a lot. You know, they want to say all kinds of things about what's wrong with your paperwork. I love demurs. I hope they do a demur, because when they do a demur, that means they agree with all the facts. All them facts are true. Thank you very much. You know? Now, why is that so nice? Well, after you make your reply on the demur, you then issue an at-issue memorandum, which basically tells the court, okay, all the argument's over, we're ready for trial. And then the court has a choice. The court can say, okay, since everybody's ready, let's go to trial. Or, in the case of a demur, the court can say, well, we don't need a trial. Let's just go straight to judgment. And if you're the sovereign of the court, you'll be writing your own judgment. It's kind of fun. So that's where you're at a decision point. See, the court, and it's the court's decision. Now, what's the definition of a court? The person and the suit of the sovereign, right? So you are not the court. You're only half the court. The other half of the court is the suit. Okay? What is a suit? Well, the original word was suit. Somehow that last E got dropped off. Okay? But the suit, what it was, the court was the king sitting on his throne, and he had his courtiers in the courtroom. And back in the days when kings did not know how to read and write, the court record was in the memories of that suite of personnel, those courtiers that tended to gravitate toward the center of power. Okay, they had the memory, and if the king couldn't remember, he'd just ask one of them, well, what did we do that day or something? Somebody would remember, okay? So that was how records were kept. As our educational level improved, well, then suddenly the record, the courtiers transformed out of human beings into 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper. Okay? And so that is the suit. So a court is defined as the person and the suit of the sovereign. Now it's paperwork instead of people. So back to if you in the after the answer, if he does answer, you reply to the answer, and then you have again an at issue memorandum, and then you go through discovery. Well, I guess I gotta correct that. You can do this. You do discovery after the reply. At issue means that you're ready. You're finished with the paperwork.
Can I have you step back for a minute,
sure,
to the demur? Why is, once the attorney goes into the demur point, why is that accepting all of your previous arguments?
Because an answer deals with both facts and law. A demur, by definition, deals only with law.
Okay.
So if there's no argument about the facts,
then
must be true.
No,
well,
okay.
It has its roots in the idea that if you fail to object, you must agree. Mm-hmm. That's how courts work, right? Okay, so that's kind of a quickie overview. And of course, you get judgment. After you get judgment, you go to collection. You know, try to collect the thing. Okay, so let's get into the notice. Basically, after all is said and done, on a notice and demand, there are 8 points to cover. In a proper notice and demand, what you do is you just step through these different points. First point is, what is he doing? He's stepping on your toe, right? The second point is, you're getting injured. Okay? So you itemize what your injuries are as a result of him stepping on your toe. And then you have to inform him that he has a duty not to step on your toe, not to injure you. And then you let him know that he's breaching that duty. Okay, let's go back to point number 3. He has a duty not to cause you injury. And you give him the moral, public, and private laws that require him not to injure. And you can, by the way, you can bring in biblical law at this point. Okay? You don't have to stick with statutes and codes. Anyway, back to 4. He is breaching that duty. And then in the 5th point is you state the damages, what he owes you for the injury. Notice this, that injuries is how you get hurt. Damages are the money that's owed to you because of the injury. Okay? That word gets misused a lot. A lot of people use the word damages when they mean injury. Okay. Then, once you've made the damages known, you then demand that he in good faith do his duty, pay you the damages, and do so within a reasonable number of days, typically 60 days for government and 30 days for everyone else. I guess government has trouble understanding things sometimes. They need more time to absorb it. Anyway, and of course, when you make the demand, if you follow their system, at least partway, you would make the demand on the Court of Claims, or you'd make it on risk management. Court of Claims is a state and federal level. Risk management is a municipal level. That's typically, yes.
Would that be, for example, a claims form?
Yeah, they have claims forms too. But make sure you get all the elements in. And if they design a form in such a way that they leave out stuff, you put it in anyway. You know, you can make attachments. You make addendums, you know, or whatever. Just, you can extend your paperwork. Just because they have a form doesn't mean that you have to follow it. You know, now they get upset when you alter their forms, but you can always say, see attachment, and make your point there. And there have been, in the past, people who have gone to jail because they altered a form. You know, well, To bureaucrats, form is far more important than substance. Okay, then if he doesn't do as you demand within the allotted time, then by tacit procuration, you will determine for him what the facts, duties, and damages are that he owes you. Now, you see, tacit procuration. Procuration means basically power of attorney, and tacit means it's assumed. So you make a demand. You serve him with the notice and demand. And now that he has proper notice, he must respond. And if he doesn't, he defaults, basically. This is what IRS does. IRS then sends out notices, and by the time you get to court, they say, well, look, you know, he admitted this, he agreed, blah, 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 you know. So the person who doesn't understand it, he gets hung anyway because of that. And finally, the eighth point is that if he does not perform as demanded, you inform him you will take lawful action in personam and in rem to defend against him and persons acting in concert with him who cause or attempt to cause said injuries in order to secure your substantive rights and to redeem the damages owed to you. Now, that language there has a lot of impact, a lot of meaning in it. First of all, lawful action means common law. Remember, when the word law is not qualified, it means common law. If you put an adjective on it, you can change it, but in the absence of an adjective, it means common law. If it's okay, and so in personam and in rem, that's basically against his person or his property. And notice we say to defend against him. There are people who have gone to jail because they've written a letter to a judge saying if he doesn't stop what he's doing, they're going to sue him. Well, that's a threat. But it's never a threat to promise somebody that if he keeps doing what he's doing, you're going to defend yourself. Okay? So always, always defend. Never attack. If you are going to attack, don't give an advance warning. Just put your lawsuit together and serve him. That's legit. That's not a threat anymore. So you're actually doing it. And it's an acceptable way of doing it to somebody. Suing is okay. If you lose a suit, that's okay, you lost, but it's still okay. Okay? All right. And you mentioned that if anybody's acting in concert with him, you're including them too. And in fact, if you know that there's two, three people that are ganging up on you, be sure to give every one of them that notice and demand. Okay? And to secure your substantive rights, that's a code word meaning common law rights. Real rights, not fictional rights. What are fictional rights called these days? Anybody know? Fictional rights, rights made up by statute or codes rather than...
Civil rights.
They don't want you to know their privileges, so they call them civil rights. Little misnomer there. Okay? And to redeem the damages owed to you, well, that's the money, the compensation for them taking away your substantive rights. So that's what a notice and demand is all about. And you can send them, basically you're giving them a notice. Constructive notice is right here defined. It's knowledge of facts which would naturally lead an honest and prudent person to make inquiry constitutes notice of everything which such inquiry pursued in good faith would disclose. You know, if I got a TV set, $1,000 TV set, and I say, hey buddy, sell it to you for $20, would that make you think that maybe there's something wrong? You know, and so you have an obligation to follow up on your suspicion and check it out. I mean, there's no law against selling it for $20. There is a law against selling it when you're not supposed to. Okay? And when you get an obvious situation like that, as a reasonable, prudent person, you should follow up and say, well, do you have the receipt? Is that your name? Do you have ID? You know, how do I know you're you? You know, that kind of thing. You want to be sure. If you purchase, if you do all those things, by the way, and you purchase a TV under those conditions, and it turns out it was really stolen, you get to keep it. That's how the law works. And the fight is between whoever lost it and whoever stole it. But if you buy something in good faith, you get to keep it. But you better do your homework and have the proof that you did your homework and checked it out first. You know. Okay. Well, that's so that's your notice.
Common law and equity law.
Well, it's definitely common law.
How about equity law?
Well, I think it's it's
innocent bystander and you bought it, you verified.
Yeah, it's a pretty solid concept. However, when the cops are following up on stolen property, they usually assume you knew, that you did not do your homework.
I see.
And they will confiscate it and return it.
So, prove it.
Yeah. Yeah, you better be ready.
Copy the guy's license and whatnot.
Sure. You better be ready to prove it if you think that, if you do the due diligence, then that puts you on the right side of the issue. Okay, so here's an example of a notice and demand. Okay, here's a person whose name is I Do Hertz. Okay? Yeah. This person's name is I Do Hertz. Okay?
I Do Hertz.
Yeah. And Ben Bad. What? Anybody could have that name. Well, this is addressed to Ben Bad. And he lives in Regal City, by the way. And Ben Bad and all others acting in concert with you, please take notice of the following. And then here's the factual background. On December 1st, 2008, I Do Hertz and Ben Bad entered into a contract, a copy of which is attached as Exhibit A. You are the owner of my royal palace, located at 12345 Calle Real, Regal City, California, the legal description of which is, we got the legal description here. During the term of the contract, Ben Bad, first, approved the choice of colors, second, regularly inspected, approved, and praised the work as it progressed. Obviously, he's doing painting, right? Probably should have mentioned that, but anyway. The work was timely and properly completed and accepted by you on December 10th, 2008. Since December 15th, 2008, you have refused to pay the $20,750 balance of the bill and the $88 reimbursable expenses, the cost of the city permit that we got.
Oh, huge.
So here's the injury. And this, look, when you write these things, you can scramble them, okay? You can write this so that it sounds like it has legal teeth, or you can write it like you are writing your dear old grandmother who has a failing memory and you want to be real nice. It doesn't matter as long as you get all the elements in. So you need to size up your query, okay? If that person, you know, different people respond to different things. Some people respond when you're nice. And so you could write a very nice, pleasant notice and demand, basically reminding of the person that they really should pay you. Or you can give it all the scary words you want and really lean on the person if you think that's their psychology. So, but in this example goes lockstep with the 8 points that were in the prior window. So the injury. I Do Hertz has suffered the loss of the value of labor and materials. The duty. You have a moral, legal, and lawful duty to not breach the contract. That duty is codified in the following places. California Civil Code. One must not change his purpose to the injury of another. He who takes the benefit must bear the burden. Common law. You may not injure another. In the biblical law, Luke 6:31, and as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. The Talmud, in case they happen to be Jewish, that which is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow. And then Mahabharata section, that's 113, yes. One should never do that to another which one regards as injurious to one's own self. So these are the moral, legal, and lawful things. Then we have the breach of duty. You are breaching that duty by refusing to pay the balance of the bill of charges and refusing to reimburse for expenses. The damages, California Civil Codes, Section 3300. For the breach of an obligation arising from contract, the measure of damages, except where otherwise expressly provided by this code, is the amount which will compensate the party aggrieved for all the detriment proximately caused thereby, or which in ordinary course of things would be likely to result therefrom. The damages are $20,750.88. Okay? Now the demand. Now therefore, I do Hertz demands that you execute, or others acting in concert with you, deliver the said damages to I do Hertz within 30 calendar days of service of this notice and demand, or show cause why said demand should not be enforced in a court of record in California. Now this is an important point right here. Show cause. Okay? Always be humble. All right? Always assume that you might be wrong. So always give the other person an opportunity to come back at you. And that's what the show cause is. Anytime you issue any order, any judgment, put in a show cause clause. Because you made the offer. If they turned it down, it becomes cast in concrete. Okay? If you don't put it in, they can always say, well, I never had the chance. This is a subtle point that a lot of people miss. Now the default. If you've been bad and others acting in concert with you failed to satisfy the demand within the allotted time after having been duly served with this notice and demand, then by tacit procuration, I do Hertz or his nominee or his assigns will determine for you the following. Now, going back on that, I've already explained the tacit procuration. The word duly is another important word you should know. The word duly means that whatever it is that you have there satisfies the requirements of both the common law and the equity law, the statutes. Okay? You use that word duly, you're saying you're conforming to everything. Okay? And that certainly seals a few escape hatches for them, if you actually do conform. Okay. So, now, since by tacit procuration, if he defaults, then you become his attorney. Okay? That's the procuration part. And tacit means, of course, that you're assuming. So you're going to determine for him that the aforesaid demand is just, fair, right? That a court of record in California may enforce the demand either ex parte or con parte. In other words, either with or without him, the court of record will proceed. And that each of you concur and are satisfied with the justice of the demand and the process by which the demand shall be enforced. I'm going to do all that for you if you don't bother to answer. Okay? Put them on notice. Further, if you fail to justify or to satisfy the demand within the allotted time after having been duly served with this notice and demand, then I do Hertz will take lawful action in a court of record in personam and in rem to defend against any of you or persons acting in concert with you who have caused any injuries to I do Hertz, to secure his substantive rights, and to redeem the aforementioned value owed to him. Okay? Please do not contact I do Hertz by telephone. In order to avoid any misunderstanding, all communication shall henceforth be on the record, that is, in writing and duly served. Please serve all communications and process directly to, and we got an address for service. Look, none of this talking stuff. Once you get to the point where you're going to put it in writing, That's it. No more conversation. Words just blow away in the wind. Okay, you get he said, I said, whatever. You put it in writing. Okay, and hang them on their own words when they put it on writing. And if they call you on the phone, you say, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you. If there's an issue, please write me a letter, and I will give it my immediate attention. Okay? Yes?
So it says right there, my question was going to be this, mm-hmm. that this would be right after the claims for damages?
No, this is the first step. This is the notice and demand. Whole thing is a notice and demand. This is the first step.
Okay.
See? Look in the case flow. Notice and demand.
Yep.
Right. We're set. This is the setup. Okay. Now that so that's the example. Now we have causes of action. Okay. There are 11 causes of action in the common law. Okay. Trespass on the case, trover, ejectment, detinue, replevin, debt, covenant. Let's see, what else? Account, special assumpsit, indebitatus assumpsit. I'll leave it to you to read these things. But there are 11 of them, and they're listed here. But the most common one that you will use will be trespass on the case, and special assumpsit. Those are the most common. And what that is, trespass is an injury that's committed with force, either actual or implied force. Okay? If somebody puts a gun in your face, says, give me your money, and you give them your money, all you lost was your money, but there was the threat of force. So that would be trespass. Don't do like one attorney did when I was in court, who said to the judge, Your Honor, there's no real estate involved in this case. That's when we were accusing him of trespass. Okay.
Oh, man.
Later on, the judge really raked over this attorney. I mean, we didn't ask for it. We just showed up. We were going to have a normal hearing. And this judge just really... I mean, he spent a good 5 minutes telling the attorney that it was all her fault that we had delays in this case. Why didn't she get transcripts like we did? Why didn't she do her homework? I mean, he really, really chewed her out. And we were just there for, we had nothing against the attorney. I mean, the judge just got fed up, So anyway... But yeah, trespass is when you suffer an injury, and that injury is accompanied by either force or a threat of force.
The injury can also be monetary or...
It's anything that you consider an injury, okay? So then there's trespass on the case. Now trespass... Your voice is carrying over. Your voice is carrying over. Okay. Now trespass on the case... is an injury that is not accompanied by violence or threat of violence. And trespass is kind of a catch-all. If you can't figure out what to put it in, put it under trespass on the case. Sometimes it's just called case. Okay? But trespass on the case, like for instance, let's say that I borrow some money from you. I ask you to make a loan. You lend me some money. And then I refuse to pay you back. There was no violence involved, but definitely you suffered an injury, the loss of the money. So that would be an example of trespass on the case. However, trespass on the case, in the example I gave, is very, very close to special assumpsit. Oh, yes, yes. Sorry about that. Yeah, we'll fix that right now. Hang on a second here. It's supposed to get bigger. Let's see. View. Oh, I think I see the problem. This is a word processor. I think. Mm-hmm. If I can find the appropriate... I'm not seeing the... Maybe it's under tools. No.
Should be under view.
Well, that's what you have under on your web browser. But I don't see... Oh, where...
Zoom at the end.
Oh, there it is. Finally, yes. Thank you. Finally. Okay, let's just go to 200%, see if that works. Is that better?
Oh, yeah, it makes it better.
Yeah, I just have to spit out here.
Okay. So now let's go down to... Oh, wait, you want to get a good focus on trespass and trespass on the case there. Okay. Injury committed with force, actual or implied. And it's immediate and not consequential. Okay, yes.
Would that go hand in hand? Can you do a trespass if you're doing a criminal complaint? Or is that
you don't do criminal complaints.
No.
No. A crime... is something that is against the state, and you're not the state. Okay? That's state business. Torts are your business.
I see.
Okay? Now, you can put somebody in jail for a tort. Okay? You just have to specify it, that that's what you want as punishment for what they did. Let's say in case of fraud, under common law. You know, if somebody... If somebody defrauds you, have you ever felt like putting them in jail? Well, you put it in the common law, you can put them in jail for that, because that is against you. And if you can get the jury to agree, I believe he'd go to jail. The only thing is that our present educational level and our present way of doing things, it's probably not likely you'd find a jury that would agree to that. But nevertheless, that... you decree, we'll get into this later, you decree what the law is, you decree everything, you know, and you just have to get a jury to go along with it. But anyway, there's trespass and trespass on the case. Now down here we have the special assumpsit, and special assumpsit is for the recovery of damages for the breach of a simple contract, either expressed or implied in fact. So it could be written or could be verbal, but you have a contract, and they violated the contract. So if you lend money to me and I refuse to pay it back, then that could fall under trespass on the case, especially if there's fraud involved, I guess, but or it could be special assumption, which is because you had an agreement.
But it can't be both.
Or you could put both in. As a matter of fact, when you put together a lawsuit, you can specify different philosophies, and they could be entirely contradictory. But whichever one fits, that's what goes. So that's already been settled. The Supreme Court said you can have conflicting counts. Okay. Or you could also... There's another one here called debt. Okay? In practice, a form of action which lies to recover a sum certain. It lies wherever the sum due is certain or ascertained in such a manner as to be readily reduced to a certainty without regard to the manner in which the obligation was incurred. Okay? So anyway, they're all pretty simple. You just have to read the paragraph slowly and in detail in order to determine what it is.
Could I just ask, so you said theoretically you can put somebody in jail if you
sure.
felt that, but there is really no way to do it with this current system.
Well, you have to face the real world, you know. I mean, there's an old saying that even Lady Liberty ducks her head when the bullets are flying. You know, you have to be practical. So we know what the theory is, but then there you have to deal with public ignorance. You have to deal with bureaucratic ignorance. Sometimes you have the wrong idea yourself. You know?
So what can you do instead within the current system that will be as close to that as possible?
Well, I'd say sue for money and take his assets if he doesn't have the money. Put him in poverty, you know. We don't have debtors' prisons. That's been, you know, everybody's against debtors' prisons, so, except the person who lost the debt. Okay. All right, so those are causes of action. Now, when you the actual mechanics of putting together an action varies according to what court you're in. But there is a general pattern in each state. So first I'm going to show you what they do in Florida. That's because I actually saw a suit in Florida, okay? And here is what it looks like in Florida. You say, you put the which court it is, which county, and which division, and then you have, you know, A versus B, plaintiff and defendant, case number and division. And that's pretty much all there is in the heading. And then you put the title of the paper as the first line, action for special assumption, in this example. Comes now the plaintiff, I'm a hurt, one of the people of Florida, and in the above entitled court of record, complains of defendant Ben Bad as follows. And you put in all the causes of action that you have, and then you say, I declare under penalty of perjury under the laws of Florida that the foregoing facts are true and correct, and that I am competent and willing to testify if called as a witness. Executed on such and such a date, and you put your name and address at the bottom. So that's the format typical of Florida. Now, if you go to California, let's see. In California, they have a little different structure. You put your name and address at the top, and you put your job title, in this case, plaintiff. Okay? And let's see, I think I can perhaps enlarge that too. Let's see, do we have...
it's in view.
Yeah, back to view. Well, we can make it a little larger. Yeah. Someday I'll learn how to use a computer. Let's see. I see. We got page width here.
200.
You want 200?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I know. I was trying it just to see. Okay. And there we are. 200. Okay. All right. It tends to wrap it, I think. No, it didn't wrap in this case. Maybe it's a little too much. Maybe we should do a view, zoom, and let's try 150%. There, is that okay? Still not totally right, but... All right, but anyway, you have the name and address and job title at the top, and then you have it says note that the exhibits must contain all of the evidence that is part of the case. Okay, but you have numbers down the left side, and they're separated from the body of the text. Then you have A versus B, the court, what county, the case number, and the title of the paper goes here on the right-hand side. Here it says action for trespass, okay, and what department. So that's typical of California paperwork.
Why does it say verified under action for trespass? Should it be there all the time?
When you verify your action, where is it? Right there. When you verify, what you're saying is that this is the truth. The facts are true. You see, there are no facts until some human being steps up and says it's true. And if a human being isn't around to say it's true, then it doesn't exist, as far as courts are concerned. Okay, so you put in an action where you verify, or in other words, you declare under penalty of perjury that the foregoing is true and correct. That means you're willing to go to jail if you're caught lying. Okay, you're serious about this. And the rules, the court rules say that if you have a verified action, you've got to have a verified answer. And I just love it when they come back with an unverified answer, because that means there's no facts in it at all. Okay, it doesn't matter if they say what happened. Signing it's not good enough. They got to put their safety on the line. If they're lying, they go to jail.
Yep. I was under the impression that verified meant it's under oath.
Yes, that's what it is.
I thought under oath meant done in front of a judge, or a person that is accepting oaths is qualified to accept oaths. Is that correct?
Yes, that is also correct. That is not the only correct, but yes, that is also
correct. What are other alternatives of correct?
You're looking at it.
Okay.
This is, you have at the end of this thing, way down here at the end, and you can put at the beginning too, although you have to modify the words slightly. Okay, you say, I'm a hurt. I am the plaintiff in this case. I have personal knowledge of the foregoing facts and am competent to testify as to the truth of these facts if called as a witness. I declare under penalty of perjury that the foregoing is true and correct, and that this declaration was executed, and so forth. Okay? That is your under oath. Now, you can also have it notarized. Now, the California codes say that if you declare something under penalty of perjury, that is as good as having it notarized. Okay? You see, when you get something notarized, you don't go to jail for lying. But you're looking the person in the eye, so to speak. There's something about being face to face that tends to make a person tell the truth more often. At least that's the philosophy of the law. And so if you're there all by yourself, then it's easier to lie on paper. But if you put down that I'm willing to go to jail if you catch me lying, then that raises the credibility level of your paper up again.
I have a question. So if they put under penalty of perjury, if we're going true and correct, they can go to jail, correct? Because
if they're caught lying, yes.
Right, because it's something small, but I caught someone from a Glendale Police Department saying that they mailed a copy of a ticket.
Yeah.
Which was not true, because an officer handed it to me right there. So wouldn't that be perjury?
No. It turns out that lying is not perjury.
Oh.
What is perjury is lying in such a way that it affects the outcome.
Oh.
You can lie all you want as long as it doesn't affect the outcome.
So if a cop signs a ticket under penalty of perjury, that ticket is in fact a verified written complaint. Or
well,
is it
not all of it. Let's say that he gets your birth date wrong. Would that affect the outcome?
No.
No. So that's not perjury. Even though he signed under penalty of perjury, that's not perjury.
Oh. But it is a legal, it's a legal paper.
Oh, it's legal, sure. But he's not going to jail for it.
No, I'm not saying that he's perjuring himself, but it is actually making the ticket equal to a verified complaint because he signed it. It is equal.
Yes.
Okay. In my case, I got a ticket. They gave me, I guess it was the wrong code, for, you know.
Yeah.
And so they gave me I went to court, nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the police station to find out why they wasted my time. Mm-hmm. They said, we were going to mail this to you, but they changed it because they cited you for the wrong thing. Here you go. So now,
sure.
Can I get the officer now for signing that ticket, and it was the wrong, I guess, the vehicle code?
No, I don't think so, because... Because, look, they have up to a year to decide what they're going to charge you with. you know, statute of limitations. Sure. That's why if you do have a case dismissed, make sure that you get it dismissed with prejudice so that they can't come back later with a new issue or something on it, okay? They usually dismiss without prejudice just in case they want to change their minds. And, you know, they get pretty mean sometimes, you know, if they don't like you. And I know one case where this guy, he was on probation because he drank a lot. And so he was basically ordered not to drink anymore during the period of probation. And so it was 5 minutes to midnight. He decided to pop a can of beer in his own home. And they knew their man. And at 4 minutes to midnight, they came in and arrested him for violating probation 4 minutes before midnight on the last day. Okay. And look, if you are on probation, make yourself scarce the last week, all right? I'm suggesting that to people who are hated by the cops, okay? Because they do get tricky that way.
I'm thinking still about the verified written complaint. In vehicle code 4123 or something like that, mm-hmm. the thing that's on your ticket, when they sign it, they mm-hmm. say that if you don't plead guilty or nolo contendere and you ask for a formal verified complaint, they mm-hmm. have to serve you with one in a way. And they say, no, we don't have to serve you because the ticket is this very... So the wording in vehicle code is suggesting that verified complaint is different than the tickets.
Well, let me suggest that you don't even go down that road, okay? My preference, there's two strategies that I would, one of two that I would choose. I would either go the common law sovereignty route, non-commercial. I mean, a motor vehicle is specifically defined as a self-propelled contrivance used in commerce, which means used to carry passengers or cargo for hire.
Or both.
If you're not doing this for hire, then it's not a motor vehicle and you're not driving. You simply have a piston-actuated engine, self-propelled, that you're using to travel. Okay.
Well, I'm using that, but you're saying just forget the verified written complaint altogether. And
well, I'm saying do a counterclaim. Sue them back. But I would go on the basis that that's one technique. The other strategy would be to go ahead and pay the ticket. Okay? Just do a lay down. Say, okay, how much is it? They tell you. You say, here it is under protest, or in other words, without prejudice. Make it clear if you can. If they won't let you sign or write without prejudice, that's okay too. You give it to them because you made your point. All right?
Can you write that on the check?
Let me finish. Yeah, you can. You can write on a check. But the point is that you make it clear what your intent is, which is that you are doing this under duress. Okay? Or without prejudice, in other words. And so now they're happy. Okay? That takes the whole burden of defense off of you. Now you can sue them with full energy. You can devote all your energies to attack because all the issues are the same, everything is the same except one little detail. And that detail is that they have perfected the extortion. Okay? They got it from you under threat of force. They actually took the money and completed the transaction. That's proof that they intended to harm you. Now you sue them, you have all the same constitutional issues, all the same common law issues, but you don't have to spend any energy on defending. And it's a lot cheaper and easier to do it that way. And you lose nothing by it other than the temporary loss of giving them whatever they're demanding.
How much time from the date of extortion do you have to be able to get your money back?
Have you ever heard of the statute of limitations?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you ever heard of the common law? Are there any statutes in the common law?
No.
Then there's no statutes of limitations.
Okay.
There's no limit. You can come back 20 years later. Although a jury might be inclined to say, why didn't you just forget it after 20 years? You know? Yes.
Can you do that post factum if you already paid, like send them a letter that it was under duress and with prejudice?
Well, you might as well just go ahead and sue them if you waited a while.
Well, if it's like a month late, not...
Oh, a month is no time at all in the eyes of the law. I mean,
so I can still send them a letter that I paid...
That's another good point, is that you establish your intent, okay? Write them a letter saying, all right, guys, you got my money, but I want you to know that... Here's what you do. You send them a letter... And the first thing you say in your letter is, this letter memorializes our conversation on such and such a date at such and such a place, okay? And then you put down exactly what happened, how you tried to sign, they wouldn't let you, but this is your intent, okay? Now that becomes future evidence. You wrote them a letter, and you might even say they really should send your money back, and of course they won't, but you made the demand. And use the notice and demand format while you're at it. Okay.
Bill, one more.
Yes.
I've contested you before on this penalty of perjury. You know, the lawyers take courses in how to make you lie, whatever question they ask. And secondly, in the common law, it's my yea is yea and my nay is nay. Why place yourself into this world of statutes and codes with your penalty of perjury?
Well, look, for a lot of people, taking an oath and doing a penalty of perjury thing has big religious issues for them.
Right.
And but frankly, these guys are not religious. All right, the Bible itself says this is Satan's world, not God's world. You can choose to be with God, but it is Satan's world until Armageddon, right? I mean, you're familiar with it. Are you familiar with that?
That's not answering the
question. I haven't. Well, no, but that's the foundation. Yeah. Okay. So since this is Satan's world, I'm going to do the equivalent of when I'm in China. I'm not going to argue my case in English. I'm going to speak Chinese if I can, or get an interpreter. So when I'm in Satan's world, I'm going to speak the language they understand. God knows my intent. Okay? So when I sign under penalty of perjury, I'm making a commitment that I will tell the truth. I don't accept all the baggage that some people like to carry with it. Now, there is a provision in the statutes, though, if you really are hung up on form of words instead of meaning of words, then... there's a provision where you can say, I think you can affirm, okay? You can swear or you can affirm. Well, affirm is a more neutral word. But some people get hung up on that. Look, all I know is there's a real world out there. This is what the common law deals with. And I'm going to deal on those terms with those people. And my intent behind the words I use is very important. And I'm sure God understands. Okay? So if you can't deal with those terms, that's fine. I mean, some of us have limitations and that others don't.
Yeah, but the attorneys take classes on how to put you into perjury. So why would you go there?
Because it's
in the Satan's world, if you want to call it what you're calling it.
Well,
and the attorneys are trained to ask questions that whatever answer is, you've lied.
Yeah, but I'm not in conversation with those people.
Because they can come back.
Well, let them come back. What they have to prove, I was lying, and not even if they prove I do lie, they still have to show it affected the outcome of the case.
They will.
Well, let them try. But I'm sovereign. What's their authority? And they have to show an injury if they're trying to take it personal. Okay. I don't think they can be successful on that. You know, I mean, this is really chopping at the branches instead of the trunk of the tree. You have to. Plus, I mean, I'm just giving my opinion anyway. You know, if you're not comfortable with that, then don't do it. although I'm not ready to supply a satisfactory alternative to you. Okay? But I'm satisfied with it. No one has ever come to me and said, because you used the word words under penalty of perjury, now we got you. Never happened. I mean, the bottom line is they want you to tell the truth. And I've never had a problem of that nature in paperwork. Now, getting in court where you're talking, they still don't bother with it because they have far more effective ways of getting at you. Like, for example, just ignoring what you said. Okay? Yes.
So, in the case of a traffic violation where one could write a letter stating that they're not subject to the vehicle code because they're not driving or they're not performing commercial activity while driving, how does having a driver's license or having signed up having a driver's license, how does that attach you to the vehicle code, and what would you write in your letter to unattach yourself from that?
Well, you can lose an awful lot of time trying to figure out all the different ways that somebody can harm you. The common law follows a basic philosophy, which is you're innocent until proven guilty. And that applies all the way around, even for the Department of Motor Vehicles. In the common law, you wait for an issue to develop rather than anticipate an issue. So when they actually give you a ticket, that's when you have an issue. Now you're saying, wait a minute, you didn't have the jurisdiction. You're causing me an injury by issuing this ticket. And you do battle on those terms. Until you've got an issue, you don't have an issue. The court, as a matter of fact, there's already been cases where the court has said, we're not going to settle philosophical questions. We're only going to settle actual events. Okay?
To follow up on her question, though, they do come back at you when you cite that you're not a commercial driver.
Sure.
That in the moment that you accepted to be under their jurisdiction in the moment you got your driver's license.
But only under commerce. If you're not engaged in commerce, doesn't apply. Mm-hmm. Look. Look, wait a minute. You ever been married? Did you get a marriage license?
Yeah.
So does the marriage license now entitle them to cite you under the vehicle code?
No.
Why?
Because there is no subject matter jurisdiction.
Absolutely. Yeah, you see, so the fact that you have a commercial driver's license does not apply to non-commercial activities.
In other words, if I was like a truck driver and they stopped me in my car, I'm not being engaging right now, so that's the same philosophy.
But you weren't driving.
Yes, I wasn't driving. Okay, I was traveling.
You're traveling, that's correct. And this was not a motor vehicle, it was a car.
Or
an automobile. And that was not a passenger, that was a guest in your car.
And when the appeals court, three judges and the, what do you call that other judge?
You don't go to appeals court.
Well, I did, and they said that this did not apply. They said that this applied to federal, criminal, whatever, and it didn't apply to me.
Well, first of all, that's why you don't go to appeals court. But secondly, it does apply because if you go to the, I think it's either the government code or the civil code or the code of civil procedure. I forget, it's one of those. It specifically says that the laws of the United States are the laws of this state. It's right there in black and white. And as a matter of fact, we have an example as part of this that I'll show you later, and we have that quoted in there. And the Constitution of the United States is the law of this state. That's in there as well. So this is not a case of federal law being imposed on the state. This is a case of the state volunteering to be under it. Yes?
Which version of the Constitution?
It's the, first of all, it's the code itself. The 1879 California Constitution, which is the second constitution, also says that California is an inseparable part of the United States. So, Yeah, and I use the second version, even though it's never been approved by Congress, because they all agree to it. We effectively contract to use it.
So yeah. I've heard certain theories that... I'm sorry?
You don't have to go too close to the
mic. Okay. I've heard theories that if you make a statement under 1 CC UCC 1-308 where you are rejecting the assumption you don't want to be compelled to perform in any contract against, you know, your volition and stuff.
Talking about without prejudice.
Without prejudice, uh-huh. that basically it nullifies the commercial agreement that you went into by getting a driver's license, that you reserve and preserve all rights that you have.
Well, yeah, because you're in your sovereign capacity. They cannot Shanghai you. Shanghai means to force you into commerce. Okay?
Okay. Well, since we're engaging in traveling and not commercial, commercial
right,
driving.
Doesn't apply.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you can have a driver's license. It's okay. Just don't think that I'm in commerce when I'm not. Okay?
Question, where did you get your copy of the 1879? I've not been able to find that on the...
It's on the website.
Oh, it's on your website. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Great.
Well, that's the current one. It's the 1849. It's hard to find, but that's also on the website.
Oh, because I've got the 1849, but...
Yeah, well, that's the one we don't use.
My question is also, mm-hmm. What happened to all the missing pieces that they don't have there? There's numbered, mm-hmm. but they're not in the body.
Well, sometimes they're removed by amendment, and other times they choose not to publish them.
Yeah.
But look, the way the thing is set up, it's real easy to get around it, okay? But... Again, what we're doing here is we're getting off into theory and away from the form that is our purpose here. And we can lose a lot of time on theory. But to answer your question, it starts off with the preamble. We the people establish this thing. Well, there's your definition of sovereignty right there. We're the creators. So everything else does not apply to you. Okay. So... That is, part of it. Now let's go back here to the beginning in this action. So, Ima Hurt, here and after plaintiff, is one of the people California, in this court of record, complains of and so forth. Now, so Ima Hurt identifies herself, is one of the people. When you use the word people, you are automatically sovereign. Okay? If you said you're one of the persons, then you would be automatically subject. But you're in the sovereignty. And in this court of record complains of, court of record means several important things. First of all, the court has the power to fine or imprison for contempt. The court is keeping a record of the proceedings. The court is proceeding according to the common law, which means no statutes. No codes. And the tribunal, the fourth requirement, is the tribunal is independent of the magistrate. So the one doing the judging is independent of the one who's hired to conduct the proceedings. If the tribunal is receiving money for his job, then he's no longer a tribunal, he's a magistrate. So no magistrate can make a decision in a court of record. California Constitution specifically says in Article 6, Section 1, that all of the courts in California are courts of record. Doesn't use those words, but that's what it means. You can look it up. And so if they're all courts of record, then they're all proceeding according to the common law. So what are they doing with statutes? Well, they get you to agree to the statutes. Now, how did you agree to it? Well, here's how you did it. If you are suing or if you are answering with the help of an attorney or if you have the normal mindset, you'll say, code such and such says so and so, and therefore this is right or wrong, whatever. The fact you're citing the codes implies that you agree to use a statutory system. That's not common law. You put it right in your papers. They look at it, oh, yeah, well, we're going alternative system here. Okay? If it's a criminal case, the way they get you is they say, Mr. or Miss So-and-so, you're accused of violating such and such and so of the code. How do you plead? Guilty, not guilty, or no contest? Well, whatever way you choose of those three, in all three you're agreeing to the codes, which is not common law, which tosses you out of the court of record and into a court not of record, which now gives them whatever fiction that is, they can operate according to that fiction. So the fourth thing, the fourth option they never tell you, which is, I object to the whole damn system. Okay? I don't agree. I want a court of record. I want common law. That means then, remember, under the common law, there's only one law when you get right down to it. Thou shalt not injure someone else. Okay? And if you don't injure somebody, then there's no law. So you got it. Yeah, you got to show an injury. So where's the injury? You went through a stop sign. Did anybody get hurt? No. Well, then what's the problem? See? That's how it works. That's common law. Go ahead.
So my question is, I just had court about a month ago where I didn't want to enter a plea because I didn't want to enter into their jurisdiction. And in order for me to get a trial, they said, well, you have to enter a plea in order to get a trial. I said, well, I do not agree with your presumption. I said, I'm not interested in that. But he went ahead and entered a plea on my behalf.
Right, and the codes say he can do that.
Yeah, and not guilty. And so I went to trial. But the thing was that, you know, I wanted to challenge the jurisdiction.
Sure.
Of, you know, the proceedings and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they go ahead and enter a plea on your behalf. And I thought that under the California Civil Rules of Procedure that a judge is not able to enter a plea on anyone's behalf because that's practicing.
Not true. It's right in the codes. I've read it myself. If you don't put in a plea, they can put in a plea for you. It's right there. It has to be a not guilty plea, but they can put it in. So but that's when you're in the fictional system.
Right.
See, in a fictional system, you do anything you want. Set up any rules you want.
Right, but
no buts. It's anything you want.
You have to respond to the ticket.
Well, that's right. That's right. If you're going to be in their fictional system, you have to play the fictional game. The thing to do is to get out of the fictional system by doing what I'm showing here. Do a counterclaim. And do it in a court of record, which is, by the way, a higher court. They call it, the name is capital S Superior capital C Court. That's the name. But it's actually, when it's not operating as a court of record, it's actually an inferior court. Even though it's named Superior Court, it's actually an inferior court. Your court is a true superior court, and you outrank them. So you do a counterclaim, or if the show's over and they've completed the extortion process, then just file a brand new claim against them instead of a counterclaim because they've injured you. They perfected the injury. Make sense? Okay. All right, so here we are. This is probably the most important sentence in your action here. You declare your sovereignty by identifying yourself as one of the people. You do not have to say you're sovereign. That's embedded in the word people. Okay? You know, you don't want to look like Napoleon with his hand stuck in his shirt. All right? You want to look like a sane person. And saying that you're one of the people is a perfectly reasonable statement to make. And to say that you're bringing your case into a court of record, well, that's a constitutional item. The Constitution says all the courts are courts of record. And if you ask the judge, he'll look you straight in the eye and say, yeah, this is a court of record. But it really isn't unless he follows court of record procedures, you see. But there you are. So you set up a court of record. That puts tremendous power in your hands. You're in your sovereign capacity. You do what all kings do. All kings have their own courts. All kings make their own laws. Okay? Yes.
Isn't the California rule that the judge can enter a plea of non-guilty on your behalf against your objection kind of in conflict with, I think, the Sixth Amendment? That
Sixth Amendment doesn't apply to you.
Why not?
Because you're a citizen of the United States or a citizen of something. you're not sovereign, and so the Sixth Amendment only applies to people.
Even if I have served the judge before that I accept the Constitution and the Sixth Amendment,
it doesn't matter what you say. You're subject. You have to establish your sovereignty. As long as you insist on being a defendant, you are subject to everything. You must assert your sovereignty. You're sitting in your castle. You see the army coming across the fields toward your castle. You don't sit there and wait until they come inside. You gather your army together and you go out and you meet them on the field and attack. That's what you do on paper, okay? So you do a counterclaim on these people. And if you delay it to the point where you've gone through the process, then your remedy is to sue them with a fresh lawsuit challenging them, and you also sue the court. You actually name the court as a defendant, complete with case number. You know, Superior Court of California, case number so-and-so. That's their name, and you sue them. You don't sue them for money. You sue them for decision. Okay?
So just for clarification, when you're served with a summons, which is a complaint, then you do not respond to it. You actually file a counterclaim to establish your sovereignty.
That is a response to it.
A counterclaim.
Yes.
Okay.
That is a response, but it sort of changes the balance of power. Okay. So that's a very important thing, and that's the exact wording. Don't tell them that you're a child of God. Okay. You've seen the stuff, I'm sure. Just this is all it takes. It's simple. And the beauty of it is that the attorneys and the judges, they read right over it. It just doesn't mean anything to them. They don't understand the power that's in that statement. And by the time they wake up, it's too late. In fact, it's too late anyway, because this is not something they can overturn. I mean, it's a constitutional concept. People created the Constitution. They are sovereign. As a matter of fact, there is a code. It's called the Brown Act, which is, you're probably familiar with it as the code that prohibits secret meetings on the part of government. Okay? But if you read the second paragraph, first sentence, here's what it says, and this is a quote. "The people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them." End quote. Okay? Now, that code does not create that. That code is an acknowledgement. It's an acknowledgement of basically what comes out of the preamble. The preamble says, we are the creators. We, the people, created this Constitution. So, the creator is always sovereign relative to the creation.
What was that code?
The Brown Act. It's in the example, by the way. We have an example on the website.
Okay.
You just click on the word example when you come across it, and it'll take you to the, and you read the law of the case, and you'll see it's there.
I have a quick question here. I see that you're using a disk for this, or a file that appears to be on disk. Can we purchase this today?
Not today, but you see, normally I would have it all ready for you.
Okay.
But as it turns out, I was busy putting this together, and I got about an hour's sleep last night. And so I thought about this, and I said, well, I guess you're going to have to get it mailed to you. However, if you folks would pass this around, that's your order slip telling me where to send it to you.
Plus, you'll get the DVD and try to capture.
Right, you'll get the DVD today. Yeah, you'll get the DVD today. So you get that back to me, and then I'll mail it to you within, I guess, 2 or 3 days, something like that, or however long it takes me to make copies, you know, and put them together.
Quick question. This would be, say the injury is done, they've harmed you. This would be started in a civil court or a criminal side, or where would you file this?
There's many different systems of law. There's criminal law, there's civil law, there's admiralty law, there's ecclesiastical law, and there's common law. So common law has nothing to do with those other systems.
So where would I file this?
You'd probably file it in the civil division because they don't handle common law anymore. Okay? You kind of have to force it on them. The civil division will handle it, but it's not civil. It's common law. Okay. It's its own category. Okay, so that's the very how you begin it, and you name who the defendants are. Okay, and they're each summoned to answer the said plaintiff in a plea of trespass and trespass on the case, to wit, meaning we're witnesses, you know. And then we go through. We identify, we say, Bad is an adult licensed by California to drive a motor vehicle and exercise all powers and authority implied by that license. Hey, you can make an accusation, and if they don't object, it must be true. Okay? He probably won't know all these arguments that we know about commerce and so forth. And he does have a license, and that's and the state of California is willing to back him up on it, right? And the state of California regulates him, right? And the state of California has a whole bunch of quality control experts out there called traffic cops. So they're so involved in it. Well, guess what? You'll see later on in this, they're responsible. They, meaning the state. Okay, he got his driver's license. He's the driver in command of the motor vehicle, hereinafter vehicle, California. By the way, this is a great technique. You say that so-and-so, here and after something, some name. Well, we had fun with one case. This woman was arrested, put in jail. And when she did her counterclaim, she named all the defendants. And then she said, here and after, kidnappers. Yeah. And you see there's a difference between calling somebody a kidnapper, which would be a conclusion, and naming them a kidnapper, which is simply a label. Okay? So, she, all through her lawsuit, she referred to these kidnappers, okay? With a capital K. With a capital K. All right? It's kind of fun writing that one. Okay. So, there's an exhibit, all right? And we identified the vehicle license number. And then Exhibit 1 is incorporated by reference as though fully stated herein. That saves a lot of writing. Instead of copying all the data, you just refer to the document and you say you're incorporating it by reference. And so that makes it as if you had written the whole thing in there. And then we said California is the owner of the vehicle. The nature of California's ownership is allodial. California is the true holder of the manufacturer's statement of origin, MSO, or allodial title. Okay? Anybody familiar with these issues?
Yeah.
I'll bet you are. Okay, so we're making the accusations. California licenses and bails the vehicle for legal and registered ownership, not allodial ownership. Not allodial ownership, okay? The vehicle is for use only by licensed drivers, the bailees. California is jointly and severally liable with BAD for the damages proximately resulting from BAD's actions. Right? See, once they take control, California can make up the rules that they would like us to follow. But that's it. If somebody gets injured, that person who gets injured can say, hey, you had an obligation to follow those rules. And if the jury agrees, fine. But California only made the rule. They weren't involved with the rule. You see, making it and being involved are two different things. But it turns out that California didn't just make, they didn't stop there. They actually get involved. They put out their quality control experts on the streets, right, called cops. They have educational programs. They have advertising, you know, where they say, you see billboards, call such and such a number when you see a drunk, right? You know, they're really involved. So they are engaged in commerce. And when they engage in commerce, guess what? They lose their so-called sovereignty. They lose that protection.
Where is that stated?
Several cases. You look it up in there. And there's wording that you'll see in this example, which was taken directly out of cases without giving attribute. As licensor, California shows three significant characteristics which are admitted and mandated in California's secondary controlling rules, the California Vehicle Code. Secondary because primary is common law. Okay? All right? California receives a direct financial benefit from California's immersion into the stream of commerce. Do they collect license fees?
They're also incorporated.
Yeah? All right. California's role is integral to California's transportation business of bringing California's own and others' services, products, actions, and licensees into the stream of commerce. That's what they're about, right? Whoops, went down too far. There we go.
So if you involve in commercial and you lose your sovereign standing, like, or if you did worse, if you confused the system, like on the one hand you're saying I'm sovereign and, you know, vehicle code and it doesn't apply to me and I don't agree with your proceedings, and on the other hand you say, well, you don't have a verified written complaint as your codes are asking for. So on the one hand you're accepting the codes, on the other hand you're not accepting it. Can you still come back later and based on the stuff that you did correctly go after them, or because you made the mistake of giving them the chance to misinterpret what you're saying?
Well, all I know is that we, the people, authorize the government to regulate commerce. Okay? So if you must engage in commerce, then you must subject yourself to those rules. Okay? If you're not engaged in commerce, then you're not subject to the commerce rules.
It's by
authority of the people. It's the Constitution which we created.
However, in writing,
you want an exception to your own instructions? Is that what you're saying?
Well, my instructions were in both opposite directions. So.
Oh, is this a kind of a rehash of the ads we've been seeing on the TV lately? We want it both ways. You know, and you want your bread toasted and not toasted, right? No, see, what I'm saying is that you're either in commerce or not. If you're going to go in commerce, we the people have authorized the regulation. So that's perfectly constitutional, perfectly okay. Now, if they break those rules, the commerce rules, in the process of enforcing, if they abuse the power, yeah, you have an action against them. But as long as they're doing their part, you got to do your part. It's a contract. And it says so right in the vehicle code. What, 15210, I think, says that if you accept a driver's license, you under the terms of the code, right, contract language, then you agree to accept service to be called into their courts. Okay? You can't get around a contract. You got to do your part. Now, when you are not engaged in commerce, that license doesn't mean anything.
But if you went to court and you cited their code, their vehicle code, as one of the things you cited, you said you're bringing yourself in jurisdiction.
Well, you're already in jurisdiction when you have the contract and you engage in commerce. Okay? You're in jurisdiction.
Well, but I am not in jurisdiction because I didn't engage in commerce.
Well, that's a whole separate issue. You keep saying you're trying to make both sides valid at the same time. You can't have both sides valid. Are you in commerce or not? Yes or no? That's
no.
The first question.
Yeah.
No, then none of those rules apply. Any attempt to apply it, they're wrong.
I think part of what he's asking is, before he had the wisdom and knowledge to do this the right way, he filed something the wrong way.
Well, that's okay.
Is there a way to retract that to get back to a sovereign state? Is that
Yes, all you have to do is sue, and any contract that is obtained, that any time you put a signature on the contract, not knowing the full facts, and they know the full facts, and they don't inform you the full facts, that's fraud. Okay, now it's eligible for triple damages. Okay, and you can sue them under common law because of the fraud of enticing you into the commercial contract, which you would not have gone into had you known the full truth. Okay, So yeah, that, you know, errors are correctable. And the beauty of it is there's no statute of limitations, and your court is the higher court. I'll show you that later. By the way, we need to stay more on form instead of substance. We keep going off into substance. Reality is more fun than, frankly, than fiction. But we need to get back to the fiction, the form here. Okay. So all this writing here has to do with California's involvement in the commerce. Okay? California affects licenses. Effect means to cause. That's different from affect. Okay, it's spelled with an E. You're all aware of that difference, right? Affect and effect. So California's effects the licenses through its various agencies to assure both voluntary and involuntary participation in the stream of commerce. See, that's a big emphasis, stream of commerce all the way through. Services, product, whatever, ends with for the purpose of motor vehicle operation in the stream of commerce. Okay? At all times mentioned in this action, BAD and California are each the agent and bailee of the other. Because we don't know who's telling who what. In doing the things alleged in this action, BAD and California each is acting within the course and scope of said agency and bailment. And then, so here, this plaintiff was traveling on a bicycle eastward on a sidewalk, parallel to the north side of 20th Street. By writing, he reasonably expects to proceed without injury, secure in his capacities. BAD turns right, he drives his vehicle westward on 20th Street. He turns right onto the driveway. Anyway, he hit the guy while he was on the sidewalk. Okay? So that's what this is all about, the facts of it. And then he has a duty not to do that. Okay? Then we have official report, and the details are on the statements in the report, in the exhibit. Okay. And by the way, whenever you have testimony in writing, then that becomes evidence. Like, for example, an affidavit. Now, an affidavit establishes facts, but facts are not evidence until they get into the court record. So evidence means it got into the court record. So then, but affidavits cannot get into the court record unless the creator of the affidavit is available for cross-examination. Now, he doesn't have to be cross-examined, but the opportunity must be available for challenging. Okay? And you'll see when you go into court, typically a judge will say, is everybody here who signed their affidavits, if he has a bunch of affidavits? And everybody says, yeah, you know, no objections. Well, then, okay, then he accepts it. Now it becomes evidence. Okay. Otherwise, affidavits are meaningless without...
So the person actually does have to be there. You can't say he can be made available at some point.
No, he has to be there, available for cross-examination. That's why the witnesses all show up at the court, even though they sit around, you know. I was at in one case where we had 60 witnesses showed up, and every one of them signed an affidavit. Okay, and so the judge was overwhelmed by all these witnesses. I mean, it really changed the balance of power because it added credibility. All this public is showing up in support of this person. Well, then that resulted in a bail reduction and so forth because the guy obviously had some credibility. But
question, yeah. Does it matter how the name is written on the forms, all caps or not?
Well, let's put it this way. What's the definition of a court? Person in suit of the sovereign, right? Who's the sovereign? You are.
Yeah.
Okay, who's the judge of the court?
I am.
Is it important to you whether or not it's capitalized?
Okay.
Right. Now, capitalization, that may be okay for the fiction guys. I don't know if it's important or not. I've heard a lot of it, but I don't care because it's always my case. If it's not a claim, it's a counterclaim. One way or another, I'm going to be the plaintiff. I'm going to be in charge of the court. Kind of nice, actually. Okay, So we have the details of what he did. And as a direct result, see, it's important when something happens and there's an injury, there has to be a close connection. You cannot say this event happened, which resulted in this next event, which then resulted in an injury. That doesn't work. You got to have a approximate cause, or in other words, a nexus or next to it. So that's what we're saying. As a direct result of the actions of BOD, plaintiff continues to incur medical and related expenses for treatment of permanent injuries, and so on. So he doesn't know the exact amounts. It's ongoing, so it's continuing to add up. And here are the damages to date, $33,000, different services. As a further direct and legal result of the actions, plaintiff's earning capacity is greatly impaired. That also has to be brought up. Now, I have to say this. Whenever you put an action together, put everything in it that you can, all of the evidence that's possible to have at the time you create this thing. Why do you do that? Because when you do that, you eliminate discovery. There's no discovery in a common law case. Okay, you know what discovery is, everybody? No questions about that, right? Okay, you there's no discovery in common law. Why? Because you put all the evidence in. So they'll try to do discovery and they ask all these stupid questions which are not relevant. Look, if you do not respond to discovery, they only have two options. One option is to go to the court and demand that the court order you to provide the facts. But if you've already provided the facts, that's meaningless, right? So that's one option, to get the court to order you, and if you fail to provide the facts, then you can be in contempt until you provide the facts. But of course, you can't get that kind of an order if there's no facts to provide. The other approach is that they can go to court and get a motion in limine, which basically says that the court orders that no evidence past this point in time will be allowed in the court. Because you refuse to put it in, you can't put it in. And that's just fine with me because I put it all in. Okay? So it's fun to ignore discovery requests.
Sorry, what was it? It was a court order for you to provide evidence, and what was the other one that they could do?
A motion in limine. I think that's spelled L-I-M-I-N-E, or is it N-I? Can't remember. Motion in limine. So, yeah, you put in everything, and then you hope they demur, because then they agree. Yes. Oh, okay. So then we have the quality of life and so forth. And then, so now that's the setup. And now we have count one of the cause of action. You have a cause of action. And then within the cause of action, you have many causes of action. And so we call them counts. Or you could leave out the verbiage. You could leave out those words, cause of action. You could say count one of cause of action, or count two. Or cause of action one, cause of action two. It's pretty loose. One of the reasons it's loose is because titles don't count. The only thing that counts in any paper, regardless of what that paper is the actual body, the paragraphs and sentences. That's what counts. The titles are only for convenience, but they have no legal meaning. Okay? So we have this count one, cause of action, trespass, and then we say the first 33 paragraphs of the cause of action are included by reference as though fully stated herein. So all that stuff we had up front gets repeated in this cause of, in this first count. Okay, then you make some statements and so forth, legal duty and so forth, and then you say the damages claimed are all a result of the injuries. All right, then you have count two. You notice the first one was trespass. That's injury accompanied by violence. And the second one is trespass on the case. And that's the vicarious liability, master-servant relationship. The state of California wasn't there threatening force or anything else. But nevertheless, they're responsible. They have a vicarious liability. And that's where we get into all this stuff of why they're responsible, because they issued a license. Okay? Any breach of the rules results in citation and prosecution of the violator. So let's see. The chain of authority from master to servant creates a vicarious liability for the master. It's a well-grounded principle that the master is responsible for the slaves. Okay, it's a master-slave relationship. Employer-employee relationship is synonymous with master-slave relationship, in case any of you felt like a slave while you were working. Okay, so California has provided the rules, the California Vehicle Code, for bad to obey. That alone is not sufficient for vicarious liability. However, California has chosen to be involved beyond the mere level of policy making. It is intimately operationally involved, with no discretionary authority, with every level of its licensee's actions as it relates to the operation of a motor vehicle. Because California is in commerce, it is all the more liable. By its own choice, every action by the vehicle code enforcement agents and California is described in micro detail in the vehicle code, with no opportunity for the free exercise of policy level discretion.
Can I interrupt you for just a moment and
ask, my gosh,
this also would apply to family law and any of that nonsense?
Absolutely. Yeah, those are all codes.
Yes.
Okay, if you're in your sovereign capacity, yeah. And by the way, if you truly are sovereign, then you own your kids.
Yeah.
We're at the 2-hour point to change it.
You want to make a change?
Yeah, we should.
Okay.
I need about a minute.
Sure. Sure.
Should we take a bathroom break? Or
did we get a bad point? I thought we were all sovereigns and super.
Yeah.
And
so we could
we have to go to the bathroom?
Yeah. You do your thing. We'll take a break.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, Dennis, we have a master-slave relationship, and you have to get permission first before you leave the job.
Okay.
Well, welcome to the nitty-gritty.